Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of True Crime on Easy Street. We're back this week with part two from last week. I know some of you don't love our part one and two episodes, but here we are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We do them sometimes anyway. Sometimes it's just too much to get into one. You don't want to listen for 2 hours in a row.
There really wasn't to a us cliffhanger. Or anybody. We're just telling two sides of a story.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, it's kind of a different side of the story or a different path through the story. Yeah. Today. You guys got the photograph. Oh, by the way, my name is Scott Wright. I'm a mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
Katie Givens, not a lawyer.
And I'm a guest, Stephanie West, and I am not a teacher anymore.
Stephanie's back with us this week. We promised she would be. So.
Yep. So here we are.
Okay, so you guys got the photo that I sent you on Friday.
Yes.
When I sucked the bug down my throat.
Oh, God.
I don't even know what that thing was.
I don't either.
I said, let's not talk about it.
I know, but I have to talk about it.
That was disgusting. It looked like an alien.
I know.
I thought you had hit it with your car.
No.
There's alien life form here, and Scott swallowed it.
I was doing what I like to call solitary karaoke.
Oh, yeah.
At my house.
Yeah, you do that.
I was taking in a deep breath to belt out the big funny line in Uneasy Rider by the Charlie Daniels Band into my remote control, which I was using as a microphone. Mm-hmm. Nobody in the audience except my dogs.
Yeah.
Having a great time.
Cats
are they really having a great time?
I was having a great time. Buford had his head buried under a pillow, if I remember correctly. So I took in the big breath. And it took me 10 minutes to get that bug out of my throat, and it just spoiled the mood. I didn't even do any more solitary karaoke after that.
Well, I would do it. That thing was disgusting.
It was disgusting.
This was inside of your home.
Yes. Well, I had the door open because it was a nice evening, so I had the door open and the ceiling fan, so bugs fly into my house.
I got traumatized when I was a kid because I was drinking a Coke at the park, and a yellow jacket had got in the Coke, and I went and took a big swig of it and felt... something in it and had to spit it out, and it was a yellow jacket.
Yikes.
So that is my only bug in mouth story.
I don't think I could drink out of a can again.
Took a while.
If that happened to me.
Took a while.
I'd have to pour into a
only.
Glass I could see.
Yeah. Well, I am weird, and that may have been the start. I've never thought about it. I'm weird now about certain beverages. Like, I guess Coke is fine. But like, I don't like to drink milk out of anything, but a red Solo cup like that you can throw, or any kind of cup you can throw away, or a clear glass.
Weird.
I think I've said this before.
The clear glass thing sounds familiar.
I'm real weird about certain things.
Mm-hmm. We all are.
Yeah. It's called a survival.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've all made it this far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes it's just sheer luck. I'm just, I have no method other than...
Yeah, don't ask me for advice because I don't know how I got this far.
Luck was on my side on that particular day when when I was young and dumb.
I'm as surprised as you are that I'm here today.
Yeah, as surprised as we all are for you, Scott. I mean, what was it? Just last week you were texting us in the middle of the night. I think Kelly and I were both asleep or ignoring you, whichever.
Yeah. Either way, I just assume I'm going to be ignored after about 9 o'clock at night.
I answer you about 6:15 in the morning.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's what I'm like, all right, there's a little something for them in the morning when they wake up.
There's the pay.
If
the
only
payoff.
You could schedule it like you can emails. If I email someone on the weekend, I schedule it for 8 a.m. Monday.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it pops in. Yeah. I need to figure out, you know what? There's got to be an app for that.
I don't know.
Surely.
If there's not, we should invent it.
I couldn't figure it out if there was.
I couldn't either.
So
apparently, Katie can't figure it out because that board's giving her fits. So,
I think we've been smooth this morning. I got it, I think. We'll see when it gets to the end.
The new board continues, and it's fantastic.
She'll text us in a panic on Wednesday. I can't get it to load. We've got to come and do it all over again.
Don't put that evil on me. Knock.
Everybody's knocking on wood here. Scott's not. He's just...
I was going to talk about Scooby-Doo before we got started today, I don't know if I want to now. What happened is Scooby-Doo, the old original ones, are available on the Max app now.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so I went down that rabbit hole one day last week and watched like the first five or six. And I thought about it. A lot of times we make fun of Katie or we point out that there are things that you and I know about. Mm-hmm. Kelly, that Katie was too young to know about.
Not
Scooby-Doo. Scooby-Doo came along in 1969. Even I am not that old. So we all have never known a world without Scooby-Doo in it.
Well, you correct. Know, the funny thing about Scooby-Doo, though, is because when I was a kid, they started rerunning those episodes mm-hmm. as if they were new.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't know. You hadn't seen it before.
Mm-mm. And I was a grown-up, I think, before I realized that was a thing, that Scooby-Doo was older than yeah. me, you know?
69 yeah. mm-hmm. was when they first came out with the Scooby-Doo mysteries on Saturday morning.
Oh, yeah. My best friend was Scooby-Doo obsessed. We were just talking about this the other day because we have this like picture of us in like kindergarten, first grade, and we're in swimsuits doing some school production, PTO.
Right.
At Cedar Bluff, you did a PTO like skit thing every yeah. spring.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Her swimsuit is Scooby-Doo.
Okay.
And
nice. I never had one of those. Now I want one.
Yeah, her whole room was Scooby-Doo. It was an obsession.
Oh, love it.
You guys ready?
Yeah, we might as well. Let's part two of Columbine. If you have not listened to part one, just go back and take
go
a
back
listen.
And do that.
Yeah, I mean, even though we didn't really leave a cliffhanger yeah, or anything, right. but it's just better. It gives you a. We talked a little bit about the two boys, Eric and Dylan, mm-hmm. who were the shooters.
Yeah.
And so now. Today, we're going to go into the actual crime a little more and talk more about the victims and maybe yeah. some red flags
yes.
that were ignored. So that's to kind of give you what you might have missed yeah. if you didn't listen to part one.
We'll meet you back here.
Yep.
Yeah. So when we left you last week, like Kelly has just explained, we gave you quite a few details about the Columbine Massacre, which took place in Colorado near Denver on April the 20th, 1999. We also talked about the history of school shootings in this country, and there were a couple of them that we mentioned last week that I want to go into a little bit today. So we mentioned the 1927 Bath school bombing in Michigan that killed 38 school children and 6 adults, including the bomber. The bomber's name was Andrew Kehoe, and he had murdered his wife that morning and then firebombed his own farm before he went to the school and set off bombs that he had been storing in the school building for weeks.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah.
He was the treasurer of the school board, this Andrew Kehoe, and he had recently lost a local election for the clerk, for the town clerk.
Well, good.
So that's why he did this. He was angry that he had lost the election. Nice. He was publicly humiliated.
And it was the school children's fault?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Just kind of takes you to that next level of irrational thinking. Yeah, I mean, that makes no sense to us, but it did to him.
Yeah, the guy had a reputation for being difficult to handle when he was on the school board mm-hmm. And just in his personal life. And in addition, he had been notified the previous summer that his mortgage was about to be foreclosed on. So he was just angry.
Yeah. Just an old asshole.
Kind of like Eric Harris.
And no one really wanted to deal with him and didn't like him. And that's why he didn't get elected. Yeah. So
he spent from June of 26 until this happened in 1927. He bought explosives and secretly hid them in the school and on his property. On the day of the disaster, Kehoe set off the explosions at his farm, as I mentioned. And then he went to the school and set off a bomb that destroyed an entire half of this school building. And then when help arrived, he drove a truck into the crowded area and set off another bomb filled with shrapnel in the bed of his truck that killed him and 4 other people.
He was trying to stop the ambulance and the hail yeah. that was coming.
Sound familiar?
How many victims were there?
38 children.
38 children. Mm-hmm. I remember that. What event, and I mentioned this last week, it was the biggest, you know, as far as deaths in a school for a long time.
Yeah.
Was there anything that has, or is it still to this day?
Virginia Tech was 32 victims, I believe. Mm-hmm.
And Sandy Hook was less.
26.
26, yeah. Mm. So maybe still, it's still the,
maybe still
the
is, yeah.
biggest death toll of a, and they, were the kids of all ages or were they younger?
Yeah, they were, I think, yeah, all ages. It was one of those collective schools with everyone. Yep. And when they investigated afterwards, when they got into the basement of the school building, they found that he had put a lot more explosives on the other side of the school building as well. It just didn't go off for some reason.
So it could have been a lot.
could have been more.
Oh.
And then, of course, last week we mentioned the University of Texas shooter. Mm-hmm. That happened in August of 1966 at the University of Texas in Austin. 25-year-old Marine veteran Charles Whitman indiscriminately fired a rifle at members of both the public, or of the public, both from the main building of the tower, and then he went up into the tower and just randomly picked people off with his scoped rifle for an hour and a half before a couple of cops snuck up and killed him. Prior to committing the shootings, Whitman had stabbed his mother and wife to death to spare them from the embarrassment that he knew he was about to go and create for the Whitman family.
I'm going to have to ask for someone not to spare me the embarrassment.
Yeah.
You know.
Good gracious.
That's ridiculous.
It just really gets you a little bit into the mindset. Yeah. It doesn't, again, it doesn't make sense to us, but it makes perfect sense to them at the time. I mean, it's just the rational thought process is gone.
Yeah. But like we said last week, again, before Columbine, this had never happened live on TV before.
Right.
That was one thing that made Columbine unique.
That's what I was, as I was listening to it, I was thinking that had to be why this one is the, you know, the first really infamous one, because
it unfolded live on CNN. Mm-hmm.
And we also started putting together that there were some things from Columbine that we can learn and we can do differently.
Very true.
And try to be more aware of just things in general, mental health, security.
Yeah, you do just, all you can, but as we've mentioned already several times, it's still happening.
And it just every time there's a major budget cut or anything like that, it's like the mental health one is first. Mm-hmm. And I've just never really understood that.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a topic for another day.
While we're here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So we talked about the prom the weekend before. We talked about the preparations that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold made in the days and hours and months, really, before that seemingly normal Tuesday morning happened.
Did they go to the prom?
Yes.
Dylan did. Mm-hmm. Eric did not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dylan,
I imagine the prom was beneath Eric.
He stayed home that night and watched a movie with a girl, with a female friend of his.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, I think he probably just didn't want to go.
Just didn't want to go.
We talked last week about the events of months later when the parents of the two shooters and everyone else, well, not everyone else, but others got to see finally some of the results of the investigations that had taken place to try and determine what happened and how it happened. And today, mediocre journalist that I am, we're going to try to get into the who. Did somebody help them? The authorities initially suspected that there must have been multiple people involved. That's one reason why they didn't rush into the school. They didn't know how many people they were dealing with. They assumed that something this organized and elaborate must have had multiple members involved.
Yeah.
So we're going to dig into that a little bit. And how did all of those hours of planning by, it turns out, just Harris and Klebold, how did that all go undetected by their parents? We're going to talk about that today. And with Kelly's help, because of her background, we're going to try to figure out why this happened. Why these two shooters did these horrible things in this otherwise quiet, neighborly place in Colorado. One day after the anniversary of both the FBI siege at David Koresh's Waco compound. Anniversary-wise, that was in 1993. And then on April the 19th, 1995, that was the date of the Oklahoma City bombing. And April the 20th, guess whose birthday that is? Adolf Hitler.
Ugh.
So there was speculation immediately that that had something to do with why this happened on the day that it did. In fact, there's one story that says that Harris and Klebold had intended to perpetrate the Columbine massacre on April the 19th because of the association he had made about wanting to kill more people than Timothy McVeigh had killed. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, it didn't go off as planned. He did have to buy some more ammunition that night. He sent a friend of his to, I think, Walmart or Kmart to buy more ammunition because he didn't feel like he had enough. So there's speculation that it was going to be the 19th. He felt like he needed some more bullets. So he got the bullets that night and they did it on Tuesday morning instead.
So who was the friend that went and purchased the bullets?
It was either a former coworker of his at the pizza place where they all worked. Mm-hmm. It was somebody who was of age. But the thing about it was, that doesn't really make any sense. Harris was of age himself at the time. Maybe didn't want to implicate himself or risk getting caught with something that he knew he shouldn't have.
I don't know.
But he had a friend go and purchase him like 2 boxes of ammunition that night.
I've always heard that the 420 reference was indeed a 420 reference as well.
Oh, see, there's another theory for you. So I think Dylan had experimented a little bit with marijuana because his brother had smoked marijuana, but there's no indication that Eric Harris really even liked alcohol or any sort of drug. So I don't really think drugs were the thing.
He probably didn't want to not be in control.
That sounds exactly right. Yeah.
In control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, Dylan did dabble with alcohol. Wasn't his name like
that's right.
Vodka
his nickname was Vodka he liked to drink. And he another thing that he successfully hid from his parents.
Mm. Well, that doesn't help with depression.
Yeah.
No, and that's also not uncommon. A lot of kids hide alcohol from their parents successfully. So
sure.
That's, you know, just to kind of throw that in there.
Yeah, he would spend hours at night in his room sharing on his computer, like on Yahoo Messenger or AOL Messenger, back when you could go into chat rooms and talk to other people. Mm-hmm. He found a level of social bravery online that he didn't have in person.
Mm. As do a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Because April the 20th, which has passed now, today's the 24th of April, as you listen at home. Because it marked the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre, there's still plenty of debate about exactly why it happened. There's probably a new documentary that's out right now since it's the anniversary. I haven't found it yet, but I haven't been looking. But I bet there is one somewhere. Last week, I mentioned that the goth angle, we talked about that as a possible reason for what they did. And we talked about the bullying. Some people blame video games. There's a violent video game called Doom that they played. It's the first a very early... Not very sophisticated in appearance first-person shooter game. Mm. I remember playing it in college.
There's absolutely... I mean, there are plenty of studies out there that will show you that is a thing. Mm-hmm. You can play violent video games, you can watch violent movies, violent shows, and it can affect you in other ways. If you have a maturing brain or a brain that is... struggling with different things
in some way, right?
It absolutely can affect you. And if you don't believe that, sit down for a week and all you do is watch violent movies and play violent video games, or let's throw ourselves in there, listen to true crime podcasts every single day and see how it affects your mood.
Yeah.
See how it affects you.
You're right.
And there is no question that can affect you. And I'm so tired of hearing that it doesn't.
And if you've got some natural proclivity to lean in that direction, it's just a shove. It's another shove.
For some people, it won't. But, you know, it's not going to drive everybody to this point.
Yeah.
And that's certainly not... to take fault away from someone who does something like this. So I don't want to be, you know, misconstrued as thinking that, but it absolutely affects you. You are what you consume, what you watch, what you read, those thoughts in your mind. You have to take control of that.
Yeah.
Well, and one word you mentioned last week, Scott, was desensitized.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's why we throw out the palate cleanser every now and then, because sometimes you need...
Yeah, we're trying to scrub your brain a little bit when we feel like we need to.
It's why every day at work, when I take my lunch break, I watch an episode of Community or Brooklyn Nine-Nine or something that's funny that takes, you know, or I read a book that's, you know, takes me away from reality.
Or you share a story about swallowing a bug while you're singing karaoke at your house late at night.
Exactly. So,
So as Dave Cullen, one of the authors I mentioned, as he wrote in his book titled Columbine, most of us remember Columbine as a pair of outcast goths who were from the Trenchcoat Mafia, who snapped and tore through their high school hunting down jocks to settle a long-running feud. None of that happened.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Did most of those elements exist at Columbine? Yes. But it wasn't the perfect soup that a lot of folks have tried to use to explain away what might have happened and why.
Mm-hmm.
And it also had nothing to do with Marilyn Manson music. There's another one. It didn't have anything to do with Hitler's birthday.
We try so much to do the Satanic Panic.
Sure.
And just, you know.
Oh, wait until we do West Memphis May.
But, yeah. But I will say that that is another element. The music that you listen to can affect your mood, can affect the way you think and the way that you act, especially if you are a young, impressionable person.
Yeah. There were lawsuits that tried to explain away what happened because pharmaceutical companies had manufactured an anti-anger, anti-anxiety pill that Eric Harris had been taking, but it turned out he wasn't taking his medicine.
Well, then that the pharmaceuticals Shocker. Have nothing to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a rabbit hole. We're going to skip right over it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I don't take my medication, I'm not fun to be around.
Yeah. So I'm told.
That was lighthearted, but he should have been.
Yeah.
You can't say that the medication wasn't working if you're not taking it every day or worse, sporadic.
Yeah. So Harris and Klebold had been steady companions for at least 3 years. We don't know exactly when they met, but it was sometime in grade school where their paths crossed and they were in the same class. Mm-hmm. For the first
it was like
time.
Eighth grade, maybe. It was mentioned.
That's, yeah, junior high. Mm-hmm. So Harris and Klebold did a lot of things together in the years that led up to April the 20th, 1999. A lot of things that their parents knew about. They dined out. They went to movies late at night. They camped in the hills for the weekend. And they did a lot more things together that their parents did not know about, which is probably pretty typical for any teenage boy. Mm-hmm. And this is where you will find plenty of people willing and eager to point their fingers at the parents because, hey, you should have known what your kid was doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Inspect their rooms, they say. Their journals would have been found, certainly, and everything that Eric Harris intended to do at Columbine was written down in his journal.
And where was his journal found?
I don't know, hidden somewhere in his room.
But like
cops found it.
How ethical do we feel like reading someone's journal is, even your kids? Like, is that a thing people do?
I don't think that's...
Is that a thing? Yeah, Kelly, yeah. Are you supposed to read your kid's journal? Is that a thing?
I don't think it's the first thing you do. I mean, I think something else has to happen for you to think, hey, maybe...
If they've not given you a reason to read it, you don't read it.
Yeah, that's a tough one because they do... You know, your kids do need to have some form of something that's private that they can...
Well, they have to be able to trust their parents.
Yeah.
You want to build that level of trust, right? But it's not like there weren't... We've already mentioned it. There were red flags.
If they give a reason, then you turn that room upside down.
We'll tell you today what some of the red flags were, and then you can make up your own mind whether or not they should have read those journals.
I think that's, yeah.
Well, in the case of Dylan Klebold, his mother, Sue Klebold, was a journaler herself.
Yeah, so, that's true.
You know, she understood it. And yes, respected it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Eric Harris had been writing out his plans in his journal for over a year. One of the passages, "I hate the fucking world," he wrote in his journal. One FBI profiler said later that that was the moment in his investigation when he realized that Columbine wasn't about goths shooting jocks or the bullied kids picking on the folks that had poked at them and prodded them down the hallway. It wasn't about violent video games or prescription medications. It was an all-encompassing hatred for everyone and everything.
Yes.
Harris knew what he was doing, what he was planning. Klebold was kind of along for the ride. Mm-hmm. We've said this already. Eric was hate. Dylan was love and depression in their journals.
Yes.
Some of the other things that they did that their parents didn't know about, they tinkered with pipe bombs built out of PVC pipe and black powder taken from fireworks. They liked to go out on what they called missions late at night. For at least a couple of years before Columbine is when this started in early 1997, if they didn't like somebody, if somebody slighted them at school that day, they would sneak out after midnight and meet together somewhere and go vandalize that person's home or his car or something. Everybody in the neighborhood knew who it was.
They did. They knew they were doing
well,
it.
Well, they figured they knew who it was. They knew which kid was capable of doing it.
But they couldn't
prove
it. And
then lying his way out of it.
Yeah, couldn't prove it. Oh, we had reverb.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Was that the new board?
I think
we still have the receipt for that.
Yeah, I think your mic is hot.
Yeah, let's.
And I've turned it down, but then you get kind of gravelly.
Now try that.
This board sucks. No, I'm just kidding. The board's fine. I think it's me.
You sound good.
Okay. The missions began in January of 1997. In February of 1997, there was an incident involving Harris and a classmate of his named Brooks Brown. And Brooks Brown has since written a book of his own about Columbine that I have not read, but it's out there. And he's one of the classmates that can tell you probably some good inside information about what it was like growing up with Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold.
And so he was the one that had an issue with Eric.
Yes.
Okay.
He and Dylan were friends.
Mm-hmm. And he and Eric were friends sometimes, and then sometimes they hated each other. Typical teenage stuff, sounds like, on the surface at least.
But then Eric would take it a step further and go vandalize.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
And the Brown family, Brooks Brown's parents, they were the ones who, turns out, they saw this whole thing coming. They'd called the police on Eric a couple of times. They'd gone over to Eric's parents' house and confronted the parents with some of his behavior that they had seen.
And the parents, what was their response?
Eric Harris's father started keeping a journal of his own that was just dedicated to Eric's issues.
Okay.
Wow. At the bottom of almost every page, he would find some way to justify what had happened.
As you do.
I've met those parents.
Eric is not at fault. Yeah. He would write something along those lines. Not Eric's fault. They're picking on my son. Mm-hmm. Brooks is out to get my son.
Okay.
That kind of thing. He could always rationalize it, explain it away. My kid's not a bad kid.
And with him being a younger child, you know, they've already had the older son.
They think they've got this parenting thing
We know what
we're
doing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
As David Cullen wrote in his book, at one point, the Brown parents considered Eric Harris to be, quote, a criminal in bloom.
So they saw it.
Yes.
They're not the only ones, right, who saw this coming.
Yeah.
I mean, I would love to know what some of the teachers might have thought about Eric.
Yeah.
I think he was, it's like Katie said earlier, he was pretty good at fooling people.
Oh, so they weren't seeing that side of him.
If you're a psychopath, you can, one thing you're really good at is lying.
Oh,
right.
There were some issues with some creative writing work.
That's right.
That were reported to counselors and
by Eric.
Parents. Yeah. And
dead
Dylan.
Giveaway, death and destruction type stuff. And Eric would just go, hey, it's just a story. What's the big deal? I thought you wanted us to write a creative story. Here is one.
He would just gaslight that right away.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And then the counselors and all, they were buying it, and
everybody was buying it.
Except the Browns.
Except Mr. and Mrs. Brown.
And what was it about the Browns that they, how are they different than everybody else?
I don't know. There was one incident where Eric had thrown a piece of ice and damaged the windshield of Brooks's car. Mm-hmm. And Eric's father ended up having him go over to the Browns family and walk up to the door by himself to apologize to Mrs. Brown for what had happened. And he apologized, and she said, Eric, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically she said, Eric, you can fool your father, but you can't fool me. And Eric said, are you calling me a liar? And she says, yes, I'm calling you a liar.
And then what did he say to
that? He turned around and walked away.
So he didn't engage and try to.
He found somebody who realized the emperor had no clothes on.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. There was another incident where Brooks Brown told his parents that Eric Harris was building pipe bombs, and ultimately nothing came of that. There's one story that Eric's father found the pipe bomb and he didn't know what to do with it, so they took it out into the desert and exploded it just to get rid of it. Nobody's ever proven that. And the Harris family has never spoken publicly since April the 20th, 1999.
So they've
no
they've
books,
not,
no interviews. Okay. They released one statement through their lawyers the day after. Yeah. They've never said another word.
I don't think there's anything they can say when they find all of that stuff in his room. Yeah. The journals, the weapons, the journal itself.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anything that they could say.
That's how I would have handled it. I would have never said a word.
I wonder if the dad is still trying to excuse that today.
I don't know.
In his heart of hearts, I'm guessing no.
No, he's probably just tortured as everybody else is about this.
It was March of 2004, 5 years after the shooting, when the story broke. I think it was CBS News broke the story that there had been a secret meeting in the days after Columbine between the sheriff's department and the district attorney's office, in which they agreed to keep secret the fact that there had been a police report about that pipe bomb. Somebody wrote it up, filed it away.
I don't know why they would agree to do that. Well, it makes them
they
look
hid
bad.
It to cover their ass. One of the folks who was there later said it was basically a cover your ass meeting.
Yeah, definitely. We've got 15 dead people. Mm-hmm. Most of them are high school students.
And this kid built a pipe bomb and you knew it 2 years ago.
Yeah. And you didn't do anything about it.
A year ago, right. There was another incident a year before the massacre occurred, in which Harris and Klebold broke into the computer system at the school and stole locker combinations.
Okay.
So that they could open any locker they wanted to and screw around with people they didn't like.
And they're actively doing
books.
This.
Yeah, well, they got caught. I think they got a couple days suspension.
Yeah,
they were the computer nerds, so they knew more about the computer system than the guy who was teaching the class, kind of a situation.
Yeah.
So they could get into it and fiddle around. Eric, at one point, created his own levels in Doom. He got into the code of his Doom video game on his computer and created his own levels. There's one story that he created a level he called Columbine so that he could practice what he was going to do on April the 20th, 1999. Again, never proven. But that's one of the many stories that are out there.
Yeah. They got 5 days.
Yes. And I believe it said that they didn't really have anything in their code of conduct to justify. So they just treated it like you'd brought a weapon to school.
Which apparently wasn't a very big deal.
Yes.
So it five was days. 5 days ISS in school?
OSS.
OSS. Out of school. Okay.
Harrison Klebold finally graduated to committing felonies on January the 30th, 1998, 15 months before Columbine. When they came across a van in a parking lot one night and decided to break out the windows with a rock and steal $400 worth of electronics equipment that was inside the van.
And they got caught.
They were so inept at grand larceny that they were spotted within minutes. They had pulled over on the side of the road in a park somewhere, and they had the dome light on in their car, and they're going through all this stuff saying, wow, how cool is this? There's a sheriff's deputy who's pulled up behind them. They don't even know he's there. They're so locked into what they're looking at. He bangs on the window. They don't have a good excuse. Eric's going to lie his way right out of it, but Dylan rolls over.
Yeah.
He folds faster than Superman on laundry day because that's his modus operandi, so he gives it away.
Yeah.
So Harris and Klebold were arrested, booked, photographed, fingerprinted. This is 14 months before Columbine. If the clock wasn't already ticking on the end game for Columbine, especially for psychopath Eric Harris, it started that day. Because he talks in his journals about, we're going to avenge January the 30th. And that was the day they got arrested for breaking into the van.
Avenge it. You broke the law and you got caught. You know, you just that air of, there's also this dangerous level of arrogance.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and I almost forgot to tell you about the time that Eric Brooks Brown found out from Dylan. Dylan told Brooks Brown, hey, you need to go to Eric's website and read what he has written about you. And there are writings on this website that say, I'm going to shoot people, I'm going to kill people, especially Brooks Brown. And he gave out his address and his phone number. Dylan told Brooks about this. Brooks goes and tells his parents. His parents print out these pages and pages of Eric Harris's website. Take it to the police. Shoved in a drawer.
No.
Nobody thought anything about it.
Okay.
Except for the Brown family.
And Dylan did make sure to tell Brooks, don't tell him this information.
Yeah.
Now I'm mad. You said it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Now I'm mad. Did Eric's parents see this?
Eric's parents were confronted with it, but Eric had already deleted it by then because he found out, Stephanie, help me out here. He had found out that his website writings had been discovered. He was able to scrub it clean before anybody got it, but there was still the printout that the Brown family had made and given to the police.
Wow.
The two soon-to-be killers even made videos in Harris's basement in which they talked openly about their plans, but nobody ever saw those videos until April the 21st.
So when were they doing this? During the day? Was there anybody else
Whenever,
at home?
Spend the night party. Stephanie mentioned it. Harris had a basement.
That's right.
The basement was his room, and his parents didn't go down there. They didn't mess with it. They left everything alone.
Lived upstairs.
Yeah, okay. Dylan had a normal room.
I'm going to say that any one of the things that you have told me has given me reason to search rooms and read the journal.
Yeah.
Any of these things, just one of them, but all of them together, yes. And I also am, that's all I'm going to say because I don't want to go down this road. Mm-hmm. We know that the parents missed a lot of things and didn't do what they should have done. And I'm not going to pile on, but personally as a parent, any one of these things.
Mm-hmm. In the videotapes, they're called the basement tapes for obvious reasons we just discussed. You can't find the video. That's the one that the cops destroyed, but you can find a transcript of the videos online. And the rantings go into details about bomb making. They express hope that others will launch similar attacks after they do theirs. But nothing, it never surfaced on what was social media at the time. It never made it online. Nobody ever saw it. And the tapes were finally destroyed by the Sheriff's Department in 2011 over fears that it would end up on social media and inspire someone else as they had intended.
Oh, so they wanted these tapes to be seen.
Sure.
They were shot for people. Okay, so that makes more sense as to why they made sure they were never seen. It was their final rant. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. They wanted to be seen as gods.
Mm-hmm. Godlike.
After, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
This is a legacy they're leaving. And they want people to follow and take the tips from them and then go and do the same thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
that's why I was looking at my phone. Yeah. I was looking to see if Fight Club had come out.
99.
But it came out after this.
Yeah.
Because that was very much they were doing all of these things and wanting different people to follow them and this destruction and chaos and all of this.
Anarchy.
No. Yeah. Yeah. But this happened before Fight Club came out. Of course, I guess the book was already out.
The book was out.
I don't know if either one of them had read it.
They were both avid readers, but I have never read anything that mentioned Fight Club.
Yeah. And that's the only similarity that they have.
That's a valid thought, though.
Yeah. It was a very popular movie in 99, but it was later. But the book was, I don't know that it was as popular before the movie came out.
Yeah, I'd never heard of the book.
But
until the movie came
out. But they were definitely focused on the chaos and the violence of the natural born killers.
Yes.
For sure, yeah.
Okay, so we mentioned the van break-in, right? Guess what ended up happening to Harris and Klebold over the van break-in? A felony. Nothing. Well, not nothing, but they didn't go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
They got to go into a diversion program, a youth diversion program, and that means you get a year of counseling, community service, you have to pay fines, make restitution to the people you have, whose property that they destroyed.
And while you're there, I'm going through your room. I'm just going to say that again.
Hello. I know. But not the Harrises, not the Klebolds. If they completed the program successfully and kept a clean record for another year, the break-in would be expunged from their permanent records. The parents fought hard to get that for their kids. And by all accounts, they followed the program the way they were supposed to. In fact, they followed it so well that they got to leave a few months early from the program. Their counselor, their advisor, whoever was their supervisor that said they're doing such a great job, a rare case, but we're going to let you go early. Go forth and sin no more.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's what you have for folks that age who...
To give you another chance to...
I mean, I don't fault the parents for fighting to try to get that, you know, because you're thinking about your child's future.
But how many red flags is that so far? Half a dozen?
I've lost count.
So Eric and Dylan, they were angry. They were embarrassed that they'd gotten caught, first of all. And that reaction manifested itself in Eric becoming more extreme in his visions of death and destruction. as told in his writings and his journal that were discovered later.
And I'm sure they went to school and someone said something to him about it.
Sure.
Because everybody knew.
Harris wrote at one point, "I don't care if I live or die in the shootout." So he's already thinking about this shootout and he doesn't care. "All I want to do is injure and kill as many of you pricks as I can." And he doesn't mean the jocks or the trench coat mafia. He means everybody.
Yeah, it's everybody. It's not just...
He's mad at the world.
And this brown kid, was he a jock?
No.
He was just...
He was a friend of theirs. He was in their circle of friends. He was a kind of a middle-of-the-road nerd.
Mm-hmm.
Just like they were. About this time, Klebold secretly turned on Harris, and that's what we already talked about. Sorry, that's in my notes here, but that's when this happened.
That's when
he gave him up about the website and mm-hmm. don't tell him it was me mm-hmm. who told you.
Yeah.
Because he's scared of Eric too, Dylan.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
But like I said, a cursory report, nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
In their junior yearbooks, Eric and Dylan signed each other's pages with references to NBK. That's the Natural Born Killers reference from last week, and wrote about how they couldn't wait. It's going to be great. Godlike, as Stephanie has already said. So at least by then, they had been preparing for what would happen the next April, and they began collecting their injustices and plotting their attack. Three of the four guns used at Columbine were bought with money Harris and Klebold had made at their pizza parlor job. Blackjack Pizza, it was called, I think. The purchases were made by another member of the senior class, a female friend of Klebold's. It was the girl he had taken to the prom, or would end up taking to the prom. They'd had the guns for months. She was 18 before they were, and so she went to the gun show with them, and she was able to purchase the guns.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were standing right beside her. They gave her the money. She gave it to the guy with the gun, and they gave the gun to him.
Mm.
But she technically bought the gun because they technically could not.
Yeah.
She bought three of those four guns. And she was told by them that they like to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, we're going to take them to the firing range. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah.
No big deal. And like most psychopaths, we've mentioned this already. Eric Harris was a great liar.
Yeah.
He wanted to demonstrate his superiority and enjoy it all while he did it. His entire personality was a fabrication intended to deceive, and he was good at it. The end result of all of these failings was the death of 13 innocent people at Columbine High School on April the 20th, 1999. We will walk our listeners through the bad part right after this. Today's episode is brought to you in part by A&W Outdoor Services, located right here in Cherokee County, Alabama. It's almost time to tidy up the deck, clean the gutters, and spruce up the yard and landscaping around your home, lake house, or creekside cabin. And who better to do that for you than the professional crew at A&W Outdoor Services? Call 256-706-7964 and let Alan and his crew do all the hard work for you so you can spend your time this summer enjoying your piece of Cherokee County in clean, carefree comfort. Call Alan today for a free estimate or to get on the A&W spring schedule before it's full. That's A&W Outdoor Services at 256-706-7964.
Hey guys, do you know what time it is?
Tell us.
It's time to plan your best vacation ever right here in beautiful Cherokee County, Alabama.
Many outdoor adventures await. You can wet a hook in beautiful Weiss Lake, swing away at Cherokee Pines Golf Club, climb to the best view around at Cherokee Rock Village, hike the Little River Canyon National Preserve, take a day's long splash at Pirates Bay Water Park, and there's so much more.
The Cherokee County Chamber of Commerce and Tourism has a full list of recommended lodging facilities, RV sites, and campgrounds, and they're all set up to suit your vacation needs, whatever they may be.
So come see us from wherever you are located. And if you already live right here in Cherokee County, then plan your summer staycation with the Chamber by visiting cherokee-chamber.org. Thank you to all of our sponsors. All right, Scott, walk us through that day.
So when the bombs inside the Columbine cafeteria failed to detonate, because it turned out that at least the two shooters weren't very good at setting the timers on their explosives. One investigator said afterwards they did not understand electrical circuitry, and he didn't want to go into any more details for fear of...
Oh, sure.
Yeah, he's not giving a how-to.
Not giving it away.
So when the bombs didn't go off, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold got out of their cars and armed themselves. They had their guns in the trunk. Harris had a 9mm rifle and a sawed-off pump-action shotgun that he could shoot five times before having to reload. Klebold had a Tech-9 automatic weapon. It's kind of a small Uzi-like submachine gun or semi-automatic machine gun.
I don't know guns.
Yeah, me either. And he had a sawed-off two-barrel shotgun, so he would have to reload every time he fired two shots. He would have to open the breech and eject the spent shells and put two more in, close it, and then he was ready to fire again. They both had grenades and pipe bombs shoved in their pockets, and they had another bag that had some more bombs in it. There were over 100 pieces of ordnance found later in the school, some exploded, some not, that they had thrown into various places to try and light things on fire, including, when they didn't go off, the bombs in the cafeteria. At one point, you can see Eric Harris leaning on the rail that leads into the lunchroom, firing his rifle at the propane tank, trying to make it explode. Investigators would later find over 100 bombs of various types, either exploded or not, in the school. The big propane tank bombs in the cafeteria and inside the cars were what changed everything for the investigation. Because everyone was supposed to die indiscriminately, they finally had figured out. Columbine was fundamentally different from every previous school shooting because Columbine was a bombing that failed.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd still have theories for years persisting that they were targeting jocks or that they were mad at a certain group of people, but the facts are that it was not.
No. You want it to make more sense than it does.
Yeah.
You know?
You're trying to find, a logical mind will try to find a logical explanation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can't fully
explain. You can't rationalize irrational things.
No, you cannot.
So they had gathered their weapons from the trunks of their cars. They'd put on their long black overcoats and they began walking to the west entrance of Columbine High School. They had the backpack and the duffel bag with the other bombs with them. It's 11:19 on April the 20th, 1999. The 13 innocent victims' names in alphabetical order. Cassie Bernal was 17. Steve Kernow was 14. Corey DePooter was 17. Kelly Fleming, 16. Matt Ketcher, 16. Daniel Mauser, 15. Danny Rorbo, 15. The faculty member Dave Sanders was 47. Rachel Scott was 17 years old. Isaiah Showles was 18. John Tomlin was 16. Lauren Townsend was 18. And Kyle Velasquez was 16 years old. He was the special needs student that was the first one to be shot and killed inside the library. He was just sitting at the desk, staring right at the door, and they just walked up to him and shot him. So here's the story chronologically, sort of what happened that day. The first two victims that Harris and Klebold encountered once they got to the west entrance were Rachel Scott and Dan Rorbo. They were on the lawn. They were the first two to die. And both of their bodies laid in the yard at Columbine for 28 hours because everybody was afraid after it happened that they might be booby-trapped with explosives, so nobody wanted to touch them until the bomb guys got there.
Good.
What?
Oh.
Rachel had been shot four times. Dan was shot three times. They both died where they dropped. They were dead when they hit the ground. A few students nearby, when they heard these shots, maybe they recognized that it was Harris and Klebold because they thought that they were shooting a video, they said later, that it was some sort of senior prank, perhaps. So they ran towards the gun fire. And one of them ended up being one of the kids who was gravely injured but survived. Teacher Dave Sanders, he didn't think it was kids playing pranks. He suspected the worst immediately. He was in the lunchroom, and you could see out these big windows in the lunchroom into the area where this was happening. So kids are starting to gather around the windows, curious about what's going on. But Dave Sanders is immediately, let's get out of here. Everybody run. And that's when he gets the kids running down the hallway, and they get around the corner. And just as they get around the corner, Harris and Klebold walk in and they shoot Dave Sanders twice. For whatever reason, Harris and Klebold did not advance down that hallway towards him. They went in another direction. So some other people grabbed Dave Sanders and dragged him into a classroom. He would be the last person to die that day because he bled to death on the floor in the science room.
Mm-hmm.
because nobody ever came in to get him. They were calling 911. The kids who were with him, there was an Eagle Scout who was with him who knew some basic first aid and was trying to staunch the blood flow as much as he could, but he'd been shot in the face and part of his jaw was missing and his teeth were out and he was conscious, but he laid there for 3 hours and finally bled to death.
God.
Nobody was coming in to get him. 911 kept saying, somebody will be there in 10 minutes.
Was someone there?
They were all outside.
Standing there.
Doing nothing.
But that was their
protocol. That was standard procedure at the time.
So
it has since been changed.
Yeah, it has been changed. We're not going to get too hateful about.
Yeah, right.
We learned from it and changed the way that we do things.
Yeah. From there, the two shooters fired their weapons. They went back out a door and went to the edge of the entrance and they shot at kids who were running across the soccer field. Remember, you could either run towards the soccer, across the soccer field or across the street and into the subdivision.
It was easier to shoot at the ones
they were shooting at
field.
The kids running across the soccer field. They didn't hit anybody, but a deputy police officer, a deputy sheriff who was the school resource officer. We all have school resource officers now.
Yes.
Because of Columbine, but they had one at Columbine in 1999 and he was there that day. He was eating his lunch in his patrol car. Remember, this all happened at lunchtime. And he got a call that a female had been hurt and was female down was what he heard. And that was the girl who had been shot on the lawn. Somebody called 911, probably from their cell phone, because kids at Columbine, a lot of them had cell phones then. Even though it's 99, a lot of kids back in that fairly wealthy area already had cell phones.
Yeah.
Because a lot of calls came into 911 from kids cowering under tables that day. Ugh. Beginning around 11:45, 911 operators were saying that help was 20 minutes away for any time. It was kind of, they're coming. But they basically just piled up outside and everybody stood outside the yellow tape, if they even bothered to put up the tape. And
how long did this attack take from start to
49
finish?
Minutes.
49 minutes.
From 11:19 until 12:08. That's when Klebold and Harris shot themselves.
Which is an eternity.
And how long did they wait? Because you got the man who laid there for 3 hours and bled to death.
They waited about 3.5 hours.
Before they even went in the building.
Well, here's what happened. A couple of years before this happened, I think it was in 1995, Columbine School had been redesigned. The old cafeteria on the other end of the school had been turned into additional classrooms. And the new cafeteria was more of an architectural feature than a lot of the rest of the school had been. This addition, this new wing, so it was a lot of glass and exposed metal, and that's where the cafeteria was on the first floor, and the library was above it on the second floor. A lot of the police officers who thought they knew the layout of Columbine didn't realize that this redesign had taken place. So they think they're headed to the cafeteria, but they're headed to the old cafeteria, which is on the other end of the school building. So it's about 30 or 40 minutes before anybody goes inside, a SWAT team, but they start going room to room and that takes time and they're on the wrong end of the school building from when everything happened. So it took them, by the time they got to Dave Sanders, it was 3 hours later.
Oh my gosh. It's
horrible.
I mean, I understand what happened, why it had to happen the way it did from a
I'm not gonna, this has never happened before.
Right. It's still
heartbreaking.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're facing when they go in there.
That's true.
Are the killers alive? Are they dead?
They think there are a bunch of them.
Yeah. It's very organized to them. Yeah. And so they're not sure. Yeah.
Frank DeAngelis, the principal, who was very close friends with Dave Sanders, they had been coaches together for years before DeAngelis became the principal. The day after, or a couple of days after, when investigators took Mr. D through the school to see, they were kind of showing him, they wanted his version of what had happened because he had been inside for part of it. And he had saved some kids. He'd locked some kids into a room in the gymnasium to get them out of harm's way. And so he was going through the investigators, showing them what he saw and thought and remembered when it was happening. And he saw the spot on the floor in science room three where Dave Sanders had bled to death and lost it. As you might imagine. At that point, after Dave Sanders was shot, Harris and Klebold were randomly walking through the hallways of this huge facility, shooting their weapons and detonating their homemade explosives. Now, thanks to Dave Sanders and Mr. D, the principal, most of the students had already escaped. They had gotten a bunch of these kids out down the hallways, around the corner to safety. A bunch more were hiding inside locked classrooms with tables and chairs piled up against the doors to barricade them. There was smoke in the hallways at this point. The fire alarm was screeching at 80 decibels. Mm. And it was later that afternoon before anybody figured out how to turn it off. And the little lights on the wall flashed for weeks. The SWAT guys were hitting the alarms on the wall with their rifle butts, trying to shut them off because nobody could hear anything. They couldn't hear. There might have been gunfire around the next corner.
And they couldn't hear it because of the fire alarm.
This high screeched.
Oh, and they're
And the people that are stuck in those classrooms hearing that for hours.
Hours.
And not knowing. Oh, gosh.
It was around this time that Harris and Klebold were filmed famously by the security camera system inside the cafeteria, taking shots at the propane bombs and throwing their other hand grenades at the propane bombs, trying to get them to explode. They're still trying to bring the library crashing down into the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. And they still want this ultimate carnage
to take place.
Are there people still in the
lunchroom? Not in the lunchroom. No. Not in the cafeteria.
Is there anybody in the library?
There are 56 people still hiding people in the library.
In the library. So they're still trying to... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Both of them, not just Eric.
That's right.
Both of them are doing this.
Yeah, and they're... They managed to set one fire and melt some chairs in the cafeteria, and that sets off the sprinkler system in the cafeteria. So the next day or later that afternoon when law enforcement got there, there was 3 inches of water standing in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And, you know, pizza slices and papers just floating. It's a mess. It just made it that much harder to see what they were looking at.
Yeah.
It was hours before they spotted those homemade propane tank bombs in the cafeteria after this was all over. Mm-hmm. And you know, you open that duffel bag and there's a propane tank with a little old fashioned alarm clock with the two bells and some wires on it. And what's your first thought?
Oh, yeah.
The reason why we know so much about what happened in that library is because one of the teachers in the library made a 911 call at 11:26 a.m., just about the time Harris and Klebold walked in, and she left the line open for the next 29 minutes, I think.
Yeah, and you could hear.
You could hear what was going on. The dispatcher could hear pretty much everything that happened inside.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being on the other end of that call, being that dispatch going, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, just down the hall from the library in Science Room 3 where Dave Sanders was bleeding to death, the students there could hear. They were close enough to hear, even over the fire alarm, what happened next. Mm. And here's how they described it. Screams, gunfire, silence, repeat. Ugh. Back in the library, everyone was hiding under the tables or behind the library's main counter. Mm-hmm. Harris and Klebold walked inside at 11:29. The first student to die was special needs kid Kyle Velasquez, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. 9 other students died in the library that morning before Harris and Klebold turned the weapons on themselves just after noon on that day. It was 12:09, they think.
Where were they?
Yeah.
In the library.
In the library.
They were in the library.
But this they is didn't in the kill second floor
everyone
library.
In the library.
No.
No, that teacher was still under the table or desk.
Were they running out of ammo? Was there a reason?
I think they were.
They reloaded. I think there was a time they put their stuff on a table.
That's
and
right.
Reloaded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Maybe they just decided. The last thing that they did before they took their own lives was they shot out the windows again at some of the police officers who had gathered. I think we talked about that. And then for whatever reason, they decided it was time to go.
Do you think that they thought the police officers were closer than they were?
Perhaps. Like
that maybe it was.
Could have been.
Hey, our time's got to be up. And
We've been doing this for almost an hour now.
Almost an hour. Let's kill ourselves before they kill us. I'd rather die at my own hand than.
Well, the bombs are not going to go off.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. In the order that they died in the library, the students were Steve Kernow, Cassie Bernal, Isaiah Scholes. He was the only black student who was killed that day. Lauren Townsend, John Tomlin, Kelly Fleming, Daniel Mauser, and Corey DePuter. They died in that order as they walked around the room and for whatever random reason decided to let this person go and shoot this person.
And there was no rhyme or reason.
At one point, Dylan let a kid that he realized that he knew, he let him leave. He said, run.
And that kid ran.
And he got up and ran out of the library, and they continued what they were doing. It was 4 months before the school's American flag was raised for the first time since the shooting. That was on August the 16th. That was the day the new school year began. And it was a symbolic ending to the time of mourning for the folks in the Columbine area and at the school in particular.
Yeah.
And for everybody.
Did they finish out the school year?
No. Well, they were
only about 3 weeks from graduation. Yeah.
There was, what they did was there was a school down the highway that was their traditional rival, their big sports rival. And the school system figured out a way to let the Columbine kids attend that school in the morning, like maybe for half a day. And then at lunchtime, I guess everybody left. And then the other school, the teachers, the faculty of that school came and their kids came and learned in the afternoon. That's how they finished out the school year.
They shared the space.
Yeah. From
the and I don't think that was, I'm just as a teacher.
Oh, that
I'm
had to be a nightmare from a teacher's perspective.
There was not a lot of finishing learning going on. We're probably dealing with social and emotional
and just paperwork, I'm sure.
Just trying to get it all handled and just get something in for grades to get to graduation at that point. I mean, that's all you're...
I mean, they're kind of a moot point at that.
There was a $1.5 million renovation of the interior at Columbine and a complete overhaul of the library where so many of the killings had taken place because the kids and the parents and the teachers and the entire administration wanted their school back.
Definitely.
They wanted it back.
Yeah.
These boys didn't deserve to win.
No, they don't get to take our school. We're
Yeah, they wanted it back.
Exactly. I'm for that. I'm for that.
It was 6 months after, it was on the 6 month anniversary of the shooting when that video of Harrison Klebold trying to set off the propane tanks in the cafeteria with their rifles, CBS News released that footage. They'd gotten a hold of it, and that was on the 6 month anniversary that everybody saw that for the first time. And they were yelling words of excitement and encouragement to each other. You couldn't hear the video, but you could see that they were celebrating the destruction they had wrought.
Yeah. And you talked about, we talked about this a little bit when we, before we went on air, where we press record, I guess would be the best way to say it. But we talked about how they, before they would shoot people, they messed with them.
Yeah.
They would poke at them and, you know, it was a game.
Yeah. Yeah. They, there
a
was
lot
some
of taunting, yes.
Taunting, and, yeah. There was some racial slurs. There was the special needs kid, I'm sure, got made fun of.
I know they taunted him a couple of times, before they actually shot him.
Cassie Bernal was the girl who was, she was devoutly religious and must have been wearing a cross or something that indicated to them, or maybe they knew who she was, but they had a short conversation with her about whether or not she believed in God. And they laughed at and mocked at her, and then they shot her and killed her.
And that's both of them.
Oh,
again.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, I'm not trying to take anything away from Eric. I mean, we talked about if there was a psychopath in this.
He was the psychopath.
It was him. But Dylan was actively doing some of these things.
Yeah, he was.
And
he
the mother did. Acknowledges that. You know, she makes no...
No excuses.
Yeah. And he did let some people go. And Stephanie, you brought this up before we turned our mics on, out of earshot of Eric, and he let some folks go. Not just the one kid though, right? He let go.
There were multiple
Let go.
That Dylan let go.
That he said go.
He wasn't so much into the destruction as he was just ready to die.
Yeah.
And he was, like we
he
said,
fired his gun a lot less than Eric.
Yeah.
And, but
this was,
he still participated in this planning and this production.
God. Yes.
It's just horrible. Angle.
Yeah.
2 days after the 6 month anniversary, the mother of one of the student survivors at Columbine walked into a pawn shop and said she wanted to buy a handgun. While the clerk was reaching for the paperwork to complete the background check, the woman turned her back, loaded the .38 revolver he had given her, to inspect with bullets she had brought herself and committed suicide right there in the store.
Oh. One of the victims?
Mother.
A
survivor. She had been severely wounded, but she survived. The woman fired the first bullet into the wall, I guess to see if it was loaded properly, and the second one into her temple. Oh, this woman had been fighting depression for years, mm-hmm. I read, but it was the last 6 months of dealing with her injured daughter that was too much for her.
That poor daughter has now gone through two
more trauma.
Traumas that...
Yeah. If anyone out there listening right now knows anyone that they are concerned about who is visibly not themselves or possibly thinking about harming himself or herself, mm-hmm. or if you're that person listening right now, first of all, stop listening to a true crime podcast.
It's not good for your health. It's not going to put you in a good space. Yeah.
But second of all, remember this 3-digit number, 988. Mm-hmm. That is the nationwide suicide prevention hotline.
Yeah.
Call 988 or visit 988lifeline.org and get some help if you need it. Don't be too proud to ask for help.
No.
We'll put that in the show notes too, so you can have a link to just touch directly.
Yeah, and if you prefer texting, the nationwide crisis text line is 741741. If you send a text to that number from anywhere in the country, a live trained crisis counselor will respond.
Mm-hmm. True.
There are at least 6 million rabbit holes.
Oh, yeah.
That we have jumped over today. As our listeners well know, we are the 101 version of true crime.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to learn more, start with Google. Go to YouTube. It's all out there. Documentaries, videos, books by the dozens.
Mm-hmm.
We will leave you with one tiny bit of brightness.
Mm-hmm.
On this otherwise horribly overcast podcast episode.
Mm-hmm.
In that fall of 1999, the Columbine varsity football team had decided to dedicate the season to one of the victims of Columbine, Matt Ketcher, who would have been on the team that fall. They wore his initials on their helmets.
Mm.
He would have been a sophomore lineman. By the end of the season, the Rebels had finished with a record of 13 wins and one loss and won the state championship.
How about that?
Wow. The players said they had won a game for each of the 13 victims. In 2018, the entire 1999 football team was inducted into the Colorado High School Activities Association Hall of Fame.
Mm.
We've talked about the legacy, all the things that have changed in the world, in schools since that happened. Of course, there were clear backpacks. Stephanie, what do you remember about what changed?
Yeah, I want to definitely get to a personal story here.
Like I said, this was my first year teaching, and of course the end of the school year of my very first teaching, I taught at Cedar Bluff High School. That's mm-hmm. where I was.
Go Big Red.
And again,
jump in.
You know, dealing with a class of 2000 versus, like you said, you two went to Cedar Bluff.
Mm-hmm.
All these Scott kids knew each Katie other. Did, and so there were some very meaningful conversations that went on as a result. But I think lots of things have, you know, and some I don't agree with, like it was in the dress code, no trench coats, like mm-hmm. clear backpacks.
Yep.
But mm-hmm. lots of other things have come into play now. Like, you know, it's not just sit and wait and barricade yourself into a room and wait to be taken out.
Yeah.
You have a very detailed emergency safety plan that usually includes like run, hide, fight, run if you can,
mm-hmm.
get out of the building. Mm-hmm. And somewhere to a designated safe spot. Most schools have somewhere designated that we tell mm-hmm. students to go to. Then hide if you have to, but be prepared to fight. I mean, I kept canned goods. When they would have canned goods mm-hmm. brought in for the December,
the
Optimist Club. Mm-hmm. Yeah, food drive for the holidays. Any cans that were expired, I kept on my shelf. And my kids knew, if there's ever an incident and we can't get out, you get a can and it's chunked at somebody's head. Yeah. They come mm-hmm. through that door.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
There were just so many things. And now we have school resource officers that mm-hmm. are in place.
Shout out to Casey West.
Casey West, a friend of the show,
is a resource officer. Yes.
And Bo Jolly, I think, that works for the Sheriff's Department.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is not a school resource officer, but has always been a very good advocate and friend to the school system anytime mm-hmm. we've had something to happen that requires.
He's the one who does the educational classes and stuff too. So yeah, definitely.
Well, and of all of our first responders, and again, I think another thing that is important to recognize is today they don't have to sit in the parking lot and wait and try to assess the situation. It is you send in a tactical team that their sole job is to literally step over bodies and find the gunman and
find
take the gunman out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
And it's so nothing in my college preparation prepared, mentioned, or even addressed anything like this. I mean, this is
a war zone. This is a war zone. We're not trained on how to deal with an active war zone.
And it's a sad commentary that students today are in an education program in colleges that this has to be part of their curriculum now.
Yeah, it's really sad.
It's, very upsetting, but
yeah. And schools, but necessary.
Yeah, schools are locked differently now. I mean, you can't just walk in a side, or you're not supposed to be able to just walk in a side door. You go in the front.
There's one dedicated entrance.
Yes, when you go to check your kids out now, what do you have to do?
Yes, you have to give your ID. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you do.
And they're behind glass. They're, you're not just talking to something like face-to-face.
I can attest to that for Cherokee County High School. Mm-hmm. And for Center Middle School, I've had to check out kids at both area. I wasn't getting past the little square entrance area both scenarios.
The little vestibule.
Yeah. If I had been up to no good, I wouldn't have had a long way to take it. And, because I'm locked in.
The front area at Cedar Bluff looks a lot different. I was in there maybe 2 months ago to pick something up, and it looks a lot different there now than it did when I was a student.
It looks different even than when I was a student there.
A lot more security in place.
But I don't know if you would have got past Miss Judy back then either.
Oh, that's true.
And, especially you hear other Sandy Hook where the office staff tried to stop and they lost their lives trying to save the other children and the other staff members there who did try to fight and I'm not saying you shouldn't.
That's the argument that you'll get in some quarters for why teachers should be armed, and I'm not really sure how I feel about that.
That's a difficult conversation.
That's a tough one.
Because teachers are human beings. They're from different beliefs and different walks of life, and some of them are like, arm me up, I'm ready, and some of them are terrified of guns. Yeah. So I don't know that you want to.
I would not choose to carry a weapon in my career.
Neither would I.
Yeah, some teachers are a little absent-minded, like some of the rest of us, and you don't want to put that somewhere where someone can easily. Now you've armed somebody.
Yeah. Well, and you're not a law enforcement officer. You didn't choose to go into law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. True. I know it's such a hard question and debate and
well, everybody's trying to solve the problem. Everybody just has a different idea about the best way to go about it. There are a lot of different ways, and I agree with some, I disagree with others. Like Stephanie just said,
we can be reactive,
obviously,
and have plans to do that all day.
Yeah.
But what we've got to get better at is
being proactive.
Catching this on the front end is
agreed.
Looking for these
still
red flags. Yes, looking for these red flags and being accountable for our village. It takes a village, and we've got to be the ones that are taking.
When I think these reports, like that the Browns were making prior to this incident, are much more. Paid attention to these days. Mm-hmm. These reports are taken a lot more seriously.
A lot of the
lessons. And kids are more prone to, if they see something, say something that isn't right.
Yeah.
A lot of what came from Columbine was what didn't come from law enforcement before Columbine. I mean, the things that they missed, the things they didn't do, just like Stephanie just
said. It was
said.
A lot of what not to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to say that, but... Mm-hmm. At least we've been able to take this situation and try to be better, do better, and help each other. And I know that there's been some instances since then where it was like police just didn't follow protocol. What was the incident in Texas where they didn't go in?
The officer just...
stood out there.
Got there.
Wasn't
just
he
as
held
it
liable for that?
I know he was taken to court, and his liability was he was accused of being liable for that. And I'm not sure exactly.
I don't know how that turned out.
Was adjudicated.
But I want to say not in his favor, but I'm not sure. I mean,
I'm sure he never worked. I'm sure he's never going to be a police officer or sheriff's deputy or whatever he was.
But I mean, that was not protocol. That was obviously not protocol. Yeah. And
and that was the liability issue. You had this policy in place. We changed it after all this happened, and you stood outside.
You were aware of
gunfire. You didn't do anything.
Yeah,
you're the only other guy around with a gun, and you didn't do anything.
If you work somewhere and there are policies and you don't know them, that's on you.
Mm-hmm. If you don't follow, if you know him and you don't follow him, it's still on
That's
you.
That's on you too.
You're chicken out, which is what he did.
That was what he was accused of.
Yep.
For sure.
Oh, God. And then you have the issue in Michigan where the red flags are ignored by the parents and they're not, the school's saying, take him home.
They've got the next 10 to 15 years to sit around in their separate jail cells to think about it.
Well, and there was so much more evidence. I mean, technology is so much more advanced, like with their text messages and things were.
And that's what I try to get kids to understand. You know, you're texting and you're snapping on Snapchat and you think it goes away. It really doesn't. Mm-hmm. The cops can get to that.
Yeah.
Things you're putting on your Instagram, that footprint you're making on social media, you can't wipe it clean.
No.
It doesn't go away. And so these kinds of things are out there. And I do think, Stephanie, you were right. Kids are better at seeing things that other kids are doing and saying something or at least if they don't feel confident telling their teachers, they're confident telling their parents. And then the parents can, you know.
Or another trusted adult. Sort.
But yes.
One thing that Sue Klebold mentioned in this that I thought was very interesting. She talks about, she doesn't call it mental illness or mental sickness. She talks about it being a brain illness because mental, we associate that with something that's not tangible that you can't, you know, your brain is an organ that you can physically see.
Yeah.
And, you know, and she talks about it being a brain illness.
I think that that is very important to establish because when someone is having chest pains, you don't look at them and go, "We'll just get happier.
Yeah.
Listen to some happy music.
Mm-hmm.
Get over it."
Yeah.
You don't tell someone who has even less than that, who has my foot. I can't move my foot. I think it's broken. You don't go, "I'll wheel it away. You'll be all right."
Yeah. Rub some dirt on it.
Yeah. You don't say, "Get over it. What's wrong with you? Why are you so weak?"
Well, we still don't know how the brain works.
We
know very little about how the brain works. In 200 years, they will look back and laugh at how stupid we are.
Yeah. And
I'll
give you just how complex. In my grad school days, I had to do, it was like a 30-page paper on any topic that we could pick. I did 30 pages on the eye movements of someone diagnosed with schizophrenia. Eye movements.
Wow.
Got into gray matter, got into all of the, you know, the outs and the ins of what's going on, of why the eyes may dart a certain way or what they may be seeing or hearing, or 30 pages.
Wow.
That's how we don't know the brain.
I never want to read that.
I don't either. I don't either, and I wrote it. But I had the opportunity to have an actual brain surgeon as a professor, a teacher, when I was in grad school.
Yeah.
And it was, we don't know the brain.
Right. That's it.
We just don't know. And we can only think of some red flags or see some red flags and try to pass that along. But if you look at males versus females, depression is so different. Mm. It may lead to the same if suicidal behavior, but getting there is completely different in just looking at males and females. Then if you take different males with different personalities and different things, it's going to be different. But at that point, you have to think, okay, my loved one is acting differently.
Yeah.
Just differently. I don't know. And they may not be ready to talk talk to you, talk to, you know, but there may be someone that they would talk to.
Yeah.
I know that we have a big middle school following that listens to us. Yes, as much as Mr. Scott cusses anyway.
Actually, damn it, sorry.
Actually, I think I'm the, well, until then, I was the only one who had cussed on this episode. But, you know, as you're moving through middle school, high school, you pay attention to these things. We're not trying to make you terrified to go to school every day.
No.
But what we are trying to do is if you or a close friend of yours is feeling differently, acting differently, ask for help on behalf of yourself or that person. Just, you know, let's take some time and make sure that, oh, this was a situational thing. This was something that was going on with that person for this particular week, and they're going to be different next week, maybe. I would rather have that than us miss something very tragic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I will say in my 25-year career from, you know, year one when this incident happened to last year when I retired, they have also, there's been a big move in education to bring in these counselors and behavioral counselors and mental health counselors and folks to help recognize. I think here in Cherokee County, there's a system in place where students fill out kind of a daily, you know, kind of check the weather. How are you today? Mm-hmm. And I think that that goes to a counselor at the central office who watches those things, and when she sees something that comes up that seems like a kid's in trouble, they're able to address that and work.
Well,
with
I know that she's the vice principal now at the middle school, but before she was counselor, Jonna Betterton, who's a friend of mine. Hello, Jonna.
Hey, Jonna.
That where students could send her a message and say, "I need some time today,"
right?
And she would go find them or call them in, set up a time. They would talk, you know.
Did she get a lot of response from that? I mean, did she stay busy with that so the kids were willing to reach out?
Yeah, she stayed busy with that, yes. And so now she's moved on to vice principal now, so I'm sure that goes to someone different now.
But they do have counselors that come in from mental health that come in and see students, and, you know, it's very discreet.
Yeah.
And there's just like some programs in place that are starting to address these issues and trying to find a way to help these students that are struggling with depression, anxiety,
all those things. And another thing I don't like is how we've like overdone it almost to the point where, you know, kids will say, "Well, I'm just experiencing some anxiety." Are you? That's an extreme emotion. Mm-hmm. Are you a little nervous about your upcoming game or test, or do you have test anxiety? There's a difference.
There is
and
a difference.
They need to know that. Don't just go to the big words. Don't, you know. But I think I like her using brain illness because that does mean a difference. Mm-hmm. If you're just a little nervous about a test coming up, or if you have a chemically imbalanced test anxiety or just anxiety in general, that looks different in the brain. And there's chemical reactions or lack of reactions in that brain. So I like the way she puts that.
And I did see with that case in Michigan that that gun violence is the number one killer of
kids,
what we consider the teenage age group, which is what, 13 to 18, 19.
It's terrible
in this country, and it's so preventable.
It's very heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. It is.
Certainly Columbine, there were a lot of red flags. It's easy to look back now, like we've said many times. But
I can sit on my throne here and judge. But there were some red flags. Yeah. And so don't pay it. It's so uncomfortable to have to address a red flag. It is not fun.
Yeah.
But you have to.
That's how you, that's how you
it's
make better
it than
from
trying
worse.
To address the carnage that would ensue.
For sure.
It was exactly.
All right, guys. So if you're out there listening to us today and you want to say something nice about us, you can do that on our Facebook page.
Yes.
You can go to our website and find out some really neat things about the three of us, or you can order some merchandise, or you can get a link right there that will take you to our Spotify page where you can listen to every darned episode in the history of True Crime on Easy Street.
I know. A few episodes ago, I had the Omen movie started advertising like right in the middle of our podcast.
Oh, yeah.
It scared the crap out of me.
That's neat. Yeah, we've got some new ads that play from time to time. Katie will explain how that works in a future episode because she'll be explaining it to me as well.
Yeah, but if you would like to be a sponsor, local here or not local, we'll we don't care.
Sure, reach out, let us know. We will get you on the air. We've got a couple of great sponsors now, and we've got room for a couple more. So let us know if you want to do that. Anything else, guys?
Is that it? Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thank Stephanie.
Thank you for being here. That's our other thing tonight.
Yep.
We'll do it again sometime.
Yeah.
In the meantime, good night, everybody.